It's story time. You're listening to Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It, a podcast about history, technology, and getting myself out of debt. Thanks to Jeff Atwood, Daniel Boyd, and Brenda Romero, and the hundreds of other supporters who have helped make this podcast possible and helped me pay down my debt. Today's podcast episode is me talking about the time I got fired. So I was only fired once in my career so far. Anyone who read the description and was worried I was fired from the Internet Archive, not yet, but I was fired when I was 39. And so I was very lucky. I started my career in places that were hiring me, and me not just being a temp, when I was 24, when I went to work for Cygnosis, Sony Cygnosis, in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I worked at Cygnosis until it went out of business, and I was immediately hired by Focus Studios, which was a bunch of ex-Cygnosis employees working together to make video games. That company started to go down in its fortunes, and I left the company to go work as a Unix administrator. Now, the way that I became a Unix administrator was I ended up going on to ne.jobs, which was the Northeast Jobs Board on Usenet, typing in $ and Unix for a search, and finding a company in Medford, Massachusetts that was hiring and mentioned a salary. I went there and interviewed with a wonderful guy named Pat O'Malley, who gave me an assignment to show that I knew something about Unix. And when I got back with what he asked for a week later, it was wrong. It actually wasn't accurate. But he said, you know, it's more important to me that you actually spent a week doing the research than the fact that it was exactly right. You were close, but not there. I want that kind of dedication. So Pat hired me at a pretty good contractor rate and then moved me into permanent employment a month later. I was at that job for the next basically 12, 13 years. That company became another company, and became yet another company. I left at one point for about a year to go work at an ISP. That's a whole other story. But I left and came back to this first company because they offered me a six-figure salary, and I was more about money than the meaning of what I was doing back then. So I had been a Unix administrator basically from about 1996-7 until the late 2000s. It's an interesting job, an interesting one to describe. In my particular case, I was somebody who was on call 24/7 for a handful of customers, and those customers liked the work that we did and liked our personal touch. The way that we did things back then and into the 2000s, they don't do it that way anymore. We had a small number of customers. We had lots of meetings with them. We wrote very personalized responses, and we did kind of a lot of research for them and just basically being their Unix consultant. And it paid very well. I had a happy life throughout my 30s, and I was able to work on the BBS documentary by taking this salary that I was making and focusing it into movie making. Sometimes that didn't make me the best guy on the job to deal with because I would have been away for 3 or 4 days doing interviews and shoots, but on the whole, it was a pretty good balance. My co-workers who suffered me gladly, I'll just say it was Scott and Mark and the other Mark and Chris and all the others who worked with me, they knew what I was up to. I wasn't being in any sort of subterfuge about this other hobby I was into. And on the whole, things were pretty copacetic. I was on call. I was the primary call for about 8 years. That meant that 24/7, at any time, they could call me about anything, really. Questions, queries, a problem that was hitting. I wrote scripts to do things that I was working on. You know, this job, it wasn't exactly the most challenging thing. It was definitely something that I cared about because I love computers and I love working with things. But if you have the same, you know, half dozen customers for 10 years, you're kind of like some weird big family. And so that was the position I was in. Like I mentioned, my company, though, kept getting sold. It was owned by the Thomson Corporation, then it was sold over to a company called Digital Island, then Cable and Wireless came in and bought Digital Island, renamed us to Cable and Wireless US, then we were part of what Cable and Wireless would best be called, the terrible set of decisions that led to the company being destroyed. At that point, it was sold to yet another company, and that company was named Savvis. Now, Savvis was a company that was located in the Midwest, and they had come up through a real scrappy set of acquisitions and choices. One of the side effects of that, though, was that their economics were paying people commensurate with somebody working in the Midwest, and us as a coastal company, both in California and in Boston and in other locations, people got paid a lot more. Savvis was smart. They had dealt with keeping costs down, and they could see where the hemorrhaging was with the company that they had just acquired. They had gone from a few dozen customers to having over 1,400 of them through our company. And so as a result, they would look at every cost, question it, and make it better. I'll give you a good example of something that they would decide. Our data center had a security guard. Most data centers had a security guard, but they decided to get rid of the security guards. On one level, you say, oh no, the security guards are gone. But they were pretty straight up and forward about explaining to us, well, here, we're getting rid of these, you know, security guards because if anything really, really goes down, the security guard can't do anything. We're going to call the police. So we're just going to set up a remote camera. We're going to have a centralized security. And then whenever the rare visit to our data center happens, remotely we can let people in, see what they're doing. It's pretty straightforward for everybody. I liked this level of transparency. This was not something I had experienced in the corporate world. So they questioned whether or not salesmen needed to spend thousands of dollars on cell phone calls. They questioned whether or not we needed 10 machines to do something when 5 machines could do the work. And similarly, they would look at our data centers and say, couldn't we just consolidate everything in this one area and then not have to pay the electricity for the other area? People who saw it as a business instead of a set of weird concepts and dreams that could then be turned into a stock option. So I appreciated this. However, I was a relic at that time. By the time we got to my late 30s, I loved computer history and archiving way more than I loved Unix administration. The previous companies had never really spent anything on training me, so I was never set up to become a manager of people, and I didn't want that job, and I definitely wasn't being educated on newer and newer technologies. And as what becomes cloud technology or virtual systems comes into place, we were still running basic systems that were a Sun machine hooked up to a disk drive or hooked up to a grid of disk drives, and then serving out stuff to the customers who were paying a lot of money for the data that was on those drives. I was very expensive, but I couldn't be used with other customers in the way that they were using other engineers. Now, I'm not really privy to the full finances of the company, but I would occasionally get hints. And one of the things that I discovered was that I was probably making 2 or 3 times what a manager was making by their system. That said, I was one of a handful of employees for a customer who was bringing in a few million dollars a year. The company tried multiple times to get rid of me. And one way they were trying to do this was to go to my customers and say, hey, we're thinking of scaling things down, making them more efficient. We want to let go of Jason. And one customer, who I will always appreciate, said, if you get rid of Jason, we will leave this company and take our millions with us. So they couldn't fire me because I had done, I guess, a good enough job to be thought of as essential to that customer. I really appreciated that, and that got me through my late 30s. But it was obvious that if something could come up to get rid of me, it was going to happen. I knew this. I think the company knew this. I had the hints. But money is money. And at the time, I thought that a big income was the beginning, middle, and end of existence. If you're not somebody who's been making high 5 or low 6 figures, obviously any move made by a person in that environment seems like the most dilettante, wrapped in yourself elitism. But it's been quite a journey for me to realize that money doesn't really solve your own feelings. I had an associate whose name I won't give. He didn't work with me. He worked at another company. And we were talking much later about leaving this kind of life and making less money. And he said to me, you know what I was doing? I was going on to Amazon at night and buying enormous amounts of garbage to convince myself that I was free. Along with that money came complete control of your life, what you could do, what you could say. You were not allowed to have a certain kind of expression, and they could make you do anything they wanted at any given time. For the times when they didn't ask much of you, it seemed like a really good deal. But some really unfair things could happen, and some really unnecessary destruction of your social life and personality could really occur over the years. I was at that job with golden handcuffs. They paid me well, it paid for my home, it paid for my cats, it paid for my car, but that was it. I wanted something else. I wanted what I did to have meaning. So in this situation of a person who's not completely into their job, getting paid a lot according to the company, it was just a matter of time that something was going to happen. That something that happened was that my main customer announced that they were leaving. Totally understood. Their parent company finally said, hey, the data center we pay for in another location, yeah, it's not as good. Yeah, you don't get the same service, but we can really, really save money on it. So we would rather risk a little bit of downtime rather than pay the prices that we are paying. We're getting out of here in about 3 or 4 months. So during that 3 and 4 months, I knew it was just a matter of time after this company left that I was going to, in some way, get fired. So I loved my company that I worked for. I cared about all my customers. I knew their names. I knew their home lives. I knew everything about them, and it mattered to me. That's the difference between industrial scale hosting and personalized work and concierge work. As the company wound down, I gave them the same level of service I'd always given, and we slowly transitioned them out. And once they were gone, I was down to, a half dozen customers, but I knew it was just a matter of a ticking clock over my head. So here's how you fire Jason Scott. So the first problem is I wasn't really breaking any rules. I wasn't doing anything that was a fireable offense. There was a person who did commit a firing offense, so I know what those are. He had joined the company as a salesman. I'm not going to give his name. And he had had some problems. He'd had a DUI. He'd had some arrests. And so as a result, his salesman buddy, who worked at our company, kind of pushed him through and got him a job with us. This was supposed to be his saving grace. Again, somebody who's trying to make their life better, totally understand it. He took a tour of our data center with me, and at one point I mentioned how amazing these machines were and what it was like hosting there. And he said to me, hey man, you know, I bet you could host your own stuff here, right? And I'm like, I don't know. I mean, I guess you could. I don't, but I totally could see where you could. It would be a pretty good deal. He goes, yeah, like nobody would know. I go like, well, somebody would know. But, you know, that I guess if that's a perk, I guess that could be a perk. I found out a little while later that he then went to the manager of our group and said, you know, I heard that Jason is hosting his own things there. You might not want to keep him around. An incredible backstab. But I found out about it, and I went to that manager, who I did like, and said, you know, I don't host anything here. I don't use you for anything. I'm not really into that. I pay for my own hosting elsewhere. And he said, I know you don't. And I said, should I be like mounting a complaint against this guy? And he said, no. Between you and me, it's going to be fixed on Friday. So I was fascinated. And when Friday rolled around, I decided around noon to stop by that guy's desk in the other building. I made up some excuse for going there. And I'll always remember walking into that floor, finding his cubicle, looking in his cubicle, and his coat was gone, and the chair was ajar, and there was a steaming cup of coffee, because he had put his steaming cup of coffee on the desk and then went into the meeting, where they pointed out that he had been going to the hotel bar nearby on his lunch break, coming back notably drunk and being a real trouble around the office. So I'd seen the firing where your coffee cup never cools down. So how are you going to fire me? First, you have to establish me as a bad employee. To do this, they had an employee evaluation occur in which somebody who was not my manager, who I did not work with, who I did not interact with on a very frequent basis, write a 2 or 3 page assessment of my actions in which they indicated that I was belligerent, that I was not doing the requirements that were put before me, that I did not do my job well, and that I was not a team player, and that I was not somebody who was following the ethics and the rules of the company. Now, none of this was true, but I remember doing a 2 or 3 page response signing statement in which I indicated that I was signing this to acknowledge it, to continue my employment, because to not sign it would result in termination, but that I knew what was going on here. Then they put me on the worst customer in the company. And it would be very bad form to mention that the customer, in fact, was Condé Nast, the network arm of the Condé Nast publishing empire. It would be a real breach of form to mention that the company in charge of all of those magazines that you know about vacations and computers, including Wired, that it is a terrible customer to work for. My company had been hired because Condé Nast was consolidating their work and going from one content management system to another one. And it was an incredible job being done. So I suddenly found myself assigned along with my coworker onto this terrible customer. Only once or twice were we on site, but boy, what an experience. I'll always remember with my coworker sitting at a table and the manager on the side of Condé Nast, whose job was to make this all happen on his side, was yelling at somebody. There's a lot of yelling at that company. And he said, "We're behind schedule. This isn't working." And he pointed at us, not behind our backs, in front of us, and said, "If I have to fire and dump these losers to get this job working, I will do that." And he stormed off. And coming off from a decade of a pretty good honeymoon with some nice customers and some mutual respect, that was a culture shock. As a side note for people, just because I know my podcast audience, I was actually stationed at Condé Nast in this very weird room, and the room had about 50 machines, and the 50 machines had every browser and major platform that they did the sites on. So it was like a Pentium computer next to a Macintosh, next to some modern Intel box, basically to allow you to use all sorts of operating systems and browsers as a way of verifying whether or not the site looked right. It was just a way you could run in there and say, "Oh, we just heard a report," and they could reproduce it. I thought that was interesting. Very forward thinking, but definitely not something that you remember when people are screaming at you. As the content management transition project continued, I called it the equivalent of changing a car from internal combustion to an electric vehicle while the car was screaming down a hill and carrying passengers. It was a marvel of technical wonder that the project manager on our side was making any of this happen. It was a complicated interlocking set of databases, custom programming, operating system upgrades and patches. It was vaguely nightmarish. And at one point, it broke. We had transitioned to the new content management, and suddenly it had broken. There was an upgrade to a machine, and now suddenly people couldn't check in articles. Every magazine at Condé Nast that used the system, and it was well over a dozen, suddenly discovered that they could not add new articles out to the sites. And that is how I found out why someone calling me a loser to my face was par for the course, because the editors at Condé Nast are mean people, and they were very unhappy that they couldn't check things in. So I was on a con call, and I will always remember this. To the end of my days, I was on a con call to fix the problem for 36 straight hours. I'm not exaggerating here. It was Friday afternoon until Sunday. We were on the phone. I learned a trick from one of the other employees, and try to imagine that somebody had to learn this trick. It's this. If you sleep on mute on your phone with your head sitting on the phone and somebody says your name, you'll probably wake up. So if you have someone call you out, like, Jason, do you know about this problem? You will actually wake up enough to go, excuse me, what was that? Even though you were dead asleep a few minutes before, which you have to be over the course of 36 straight hours. 36 hours later, we solved the problem. We went away. Now, some point during these con calls, I said something. I know I said something because it's why they fired me. There was some sort of conference in the morning, 5 a.m. Somebody asked me a question, what about this? And I said, I'm not sure. And they said, you're not sure? You don't know? And I went, no, I really don't. I mean, I'll go look it up. And this person was mortally offended that I would respond that I didn't know something so basic. That was all that the company needed. One unpleasant conference call to decide that I'm going to be fired. If you're going to be fired, you have to be fired in a certain way in the modern era. You know, they can't just call you and say, you're fired. They can't just walk you up to your desk and fire you. They have to have a whole situation where somebody comes on site. This is the way most companies work. Somebody comes and fires you in person with an HR person, either present or on the phone, to verify that the firing was done properly, was done clearly, and that they followed all the rules. So we had a manager that was assigned to us after my manager, and this guy wasn't the greatest. He obviously talked and moved as if he had read a book on management. But he was out of the DC office, and I found out that he was coming to the Boston office for a very important meeting, and that I was invited. And I thought, well, here it comes. So on the assigned day, I was asked to go to an office, and at that office, he had on the phone a person from HR. And then he explained to me how the firing would go. And I ended up texting my coworkers saying, hey, I'm being fired. And this is interesting. HR requires that you not interfere with how the employee feels. I guess they figured out that letting them cry or hit the table or get up and storm out, like, this is all part of firing people according to the new paradigm. And so they just let me text, and I just texted my coworkers, I'm being fired, I'm being offered a severance, I'm being offered this amount, and so on. And so he basically walked me through, here's why you're not going to work here, you're not going to return to your desk, we are going to handle everything from this point on, and goodbye. So I went out, basically walked off the property. And they weren't firing my coworkers, which was very important to me. Many of them had families that would really be adversely affected. And while my family would be adversely affected, you know, the less the better. And I found out later that moves have been made to have my passwords taken away on the day while I was in the office, the classic magic trick, poof, you're not an employee. And the manager was speaking to my coworker and said, okay, so all of Jason's access is cut out? And my coworker said to him, well, Jason has been an employee here for over a decade, and I know he has a half dozen back doors into the entire system. So no. And apparently the manager just blanched. Because in his world, a person like me, upon being fired, would turn around and destroy the company he had worked for, would make some sort of logic bomb. You see, by that point, the world had changed such that there was an interpretation that every employee was a ticking time bomb, ready to turn in a moment's notice from hardworking employee to terrorist. And of course, I come from the stock of respecting end users, respecting customers, and treating them well. So even though I had these half dozen back doors, my coworker called me and said basically, "Hey, the back doors, what are they, man?" And I said, "Oh, port of this and go to here and do this." And he said, "Awesome." And that was the end of it. And that was the last time I ever worked for that company. In 2009, when I walked away, I was 39 years old. I had been a Unix administrator all through my 30s. And I ended up deleting all of the work I had done for them, all of the mails I had sent, the carefully crafted paragraphs. There is such a chunk of my life that just went out the window the moment I was let go. And that was when I really personally internalized that this perhaps was a good way to have made money and to have used that money to do some fun things and to make some strides in computer history and my other hobbies at the time. But did I want to do that again? So I reached out, and this is when I did a Kickstarter, which some people are aware of, where I did something called the Jason Scott Sabbatical. And what I said was, I don't want to do this again. I don't want to be a Unix administrator somewhere else and then be quietly working on the things I really care about at night. Let's do it that I'm doing what I believe in all the time. And I asked for a certain amount of money. People gave me that money. I finished the documentary known as GitLamp on Text Adventures. The money from that kept me going. And I had the freedom, a year and a half later, to walk into a conference at the Internet Archive called the Personal Digital Archiving Conference, give a barn raiser of a speech, and then walk downstairs and demand a job to say, "I'll work for you for almost nothing. Please give me a chance. I won't disappoint you." I haven't disappointed them. It's been a match made in heaven. And in the past 7 years, I have never purchased a Condé Nast magazine. This is Jason Scott. You've been listening to Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It. Thanks to James Bekoyanu, Sam Johnston, and the hundreds of other supporters who are helping to get me out of debt. It has been a fantastic couple of weeks. I have been going after a different kind of debt, inbox debt. I had 77 letters in my inbox. Each one was a labyrinth of response and paragraph writing, and I've gotten it down to about 14. Same with the inbox of files. I have uploaded gigabytes and gigabytes and gigabytes of material into the Internet Archive. It has been really, really liberating. I'm trying to make it that I have no online items waiting for my attention, and then I'm going to turn back to the physical items that are both in my apartment and in my storage unit and clear things out for good. You're helping me do it. Thanks for letting me rant about a very, very old event. I have no ill feelings towards anybody mentioned in this story. They have all been a part of my life. They've helped make me what I am, and it's only upwards from here. Thanks a lot.